I'll start with, anyway, I want to revise quickly another theorem from yesterday. So let's see, we had an infinitesimal variation phi I to phi x plus epsilon delta phi I x is an infinitesimal symmetry is said an infinitesimal symmetry if and only if the Lagrangian at phi plus epsilon delta phi d phi plus epsilon derivative of delta phi and x is equal to the unperturbed Lagrangian plus at leading order a total derivative, like a total divergence in R mu, plus higher order terms, of course. This could be there. If this is, and by this, we mean that the variation of the Lagrangian is a total. We often write it like this as well. Now, since there was some confusion yesterday during the tutorial, I want to remind everybody that we're not touching x ever. What you're changing is the field configuration. This is like when we do time translation, we don't touch the time. This is just a labeling of point on our time axis. These are labeling of points in space-time. We don't touch those. We just translate the field configuration in space and time. Okay. So, and and then if, now with this setup, we get another theorem. If delta S phi is an infinitesimal symmetry, then what happens? The quantity J mu S defined as well, I write it without the sum. It's just this object here times delta S phi minus R mu S is conserved on shell. Is a conserved current on shell, which means that d mu j mu is zero on shell and implies that the charges n mu g mu at so these are integrals, 3D integrals. So this is just J0 is constant in time. Okay, so this is Noether theorem, and the J is called the Noether current, and Q is called Noether's charge. So if you're doing computations and you notice some problem with signs, I think I said something wrong about this n. I put it, I wrote it with the index up. I should have written it with the index down. So n mu, the future pointing n mu, because it's really a covector, I shouldn't write it as an arrow, but if you want things to work properly, the future pointing is the one with the plus. Okay. It is the opposite that I wrote the other day. But this is a bit of a small point, so this one is J0, the J0 component of this. Okay. Good. So now I want to, the reason why I rewrote everything is because I want to catch a subtlety that I haven't mentioned yesterday.
How do we see that is a covector?
I'm just saying that this is the one. So if this is 1, 0, because these, if we were working with forms, I would have an immediate answer. But like this, the reason is that if you're doing, suppose you do the divergence theorem. I don't know if this is a good reason. So these, in a way, it's natural to keep the mu down. And so this is more the J mu that points, that is the vector pointing outwards. So this is the J0 component of J mu, which you obtain by contracting with the right covector. It is not a great answer, but that's a way to remember. Okay, so here the subtlety is the following. When I write, I start from this equation, which is the equation that is defining R mu. And then I use R mu to define J mu. But in fact, since this is contracted with the divergence, this is not unique. There are things that have zero divergence and that would not contribute to L. So I can always add something to R, and I will write immediately which form these objects must have, without affecting this definition. And if its divergence is zero, it also means that it will not affect this equation either. Right? So there's no a priori this. Here I'm just saying there exists an R mu for which this is true, and then the theorem follows. But I'm not saying that this R mu is unique. So I need to discuss what happens in that case. So the first ambiguity I want to talk about is another one. Well, no, let's let that one go. Let's let that one go. If you want, in the notes, I also discussed that one can redefine L by a total derivative, like we did in mechanics. But these kind of redefinitions do not affect J, because it changes both this term and that term by the same amount. So that one will not contribute. I will not discuss. You can find it in the notes. The important one is the ambiguity in R mu. So d over dx, the equation delta s of L equal d over dx mu of R mu does not uniquely determined are mu. So we, the left-hand side is what we compute, and from the left-hand side we know that this is a total derivative, but we need to extract the argument of that total divergence, sorry, and this is not unique. And in fact, I can redefine R mu as the old one. Now, let's see my conventions. Minus I can always redefine something like this, provided that psi mu nu is antisymmetric in its indices. If it is antisymmetric, its divergence will automatically be zero, because I'm the derivative in different directions commutes, but this is antisymmetric, so the divergence of this object will be zero. So I can put it in send here and nothing will change. And you know, is just as good. But this will influence my J. Will affect my definition of J. Why? Because J mu is then sent to J mu prime equal to J mu s plus d over dx nu of psi nu mu. So there is a problem in the sense that we want to give a physical meaning to these currents, but in reality, these currents are ambiguous, and this is completely arbitrary. Could be anything you like as long as it's antisymmetric. Now, what we can do is to check what happens to the charges. So these currents have this issue, but what about the charge? What about the charge? So let's compute it. We get Q of S of T is the integral in sigma T of over the three surface of J0. So Q prime will be the integral of J0 plus d over dx nu plus nu 0. So this is our new charge, but this is antisymmetric, so it means that nu itself cannot be 0, it must be I. So this will be J naught. Well, let's, so the first term is the old charge, of course, so we get Qs of t plus the integral of sigma t d3x d over dxi psi I0. But this is a divergence in the quantity we're integrating over. So we can integrate, we can use the divergence theorem, and this becomes, oops, an integral across the boundary of my 2D surface of, well, here I should put, let's do it properly. So this is psi I zero, if you want, d sigma I. Okay? So d, no, I don't like sigma. What do we call it? S, dsi. So this is a 2D integral. Of course, if this surface is at infinity and everything is decaying fast enough, this will not contribute. or if you're in a closed universe. Here, of course, my setup is adapted to Minkowski. However, it can be easily generalized to be on a curved universe as well. So if my space-like slice has no boundaries anywhere, this will not be there. Or if it has at infinity, if things fall off fast enough. So here we need some hypotheses, which if you want is technical, but is in fact, in general, can be subtle. But if fields at infinity fall off fast enough, so this is a sphere at infinity, this becomes just Q. So this problem with the neutral current is somewhat solved by looking at the neutral charges, provided we have some technical hypothesis that tells us that at very far away of our sources, nothing of interest is happening. So this is about this ambiguity. So these currents are useful because they are conserved. They can be used also in the quantum theory to study world identities and so on. They're very useful. It's not that because they're ambiguous, they're not useful. And often they carry a lot of physical information, as we saw yesterday with the stress energy tensor that I will revise now. However, one has to keep in mind that one can tweak them if one needs by using this ambiguity. So just to give a name, this psi mu nu sometimes is called the superpotential. I don't really like this name, but you can find it in the literature. So I just.
Psi is arbitrary, right?
Yeah, completely arbitrary. As long as it's anti-symmetric.
As long as it's asymmetric, it's satisfied. Yeah. So it doesn't have to vanish at infinity. Right?
No, but this will be a function of our fields. So, okay, if psi. Okay, so you're right. So I should maybe be a bit more specific. So this psi, note, can be a function of our field and also of x. I can choose it as I like. There's nothing here stopping me to taking it field dependent. If it's not field dependent, it's true, it might be a constant. But then I'm just shifting the charges by a constant, and this is not really important for anything. So in the mechanical case, why we didn't see these? Well, we didn't see these because these are time derivatives. So what we're missing at most are constants in time. So and we don't have space to play around. So these were just real numbers. So this was just shifting our charges our current by a real number. So this is what we talked about yesterday, that energy is defined up to a constant, things like this. So it's much less severe of an ambiguity in the mechanical case than in field theory. And we will see at the end of this lecture why this, that in fact this is not just a curiosity, it's also important in practice. Okay, very good. So in this sense, if the fields vanish fast enough, then psi goes to zero when the fields are zero. Psi of phi, zero at infinity, and this becomes like that. Okay. I suppose it's called the potential because it appears with a derivative in front, but I don't see any other good reason personally. And the super, I'm not really sure why there is a super. So that's why this name, I don't find it particularly enlightening. Okay. Now, today I will solve yesterday's tutorial, essentially. So I will go through everything slowly and Hopefully you have already seen it, so you have an idea of what we're talking about, and it will be clear. I don't think I will go farther or much farther than where the tutorial stopped. Okay, so now we want to study the Noether theorem. Yeah, last time we saw it in this case of this complex scalar field, we get this particular current for the phase symmetry of our field. Today we study a case which is more ubiquitous. The other one is important if you have a charge field, for example, but this one is even more important, and it is the translational symmetry and the stress energy tensor. So what is the symmetry is, I take a field, and when I translate it, I say I have a new field, phi prime. Did I call it prime? No, I didn't. Which is, the same as my old field, but at a different point. So this is, notice again, I'm not changing x, I'm changing the field itself. So in this case, if a is small, this will be equal to my original x plus a mu d mu phi of x. And this is, let's say epsilon a, epsilon. So this will be what I was calling delta s phi, and this, and then there are higher orders in epsilon. So this is our delta for the translational symmetry. And a is a constant in this game. So here, 4a, it's a constant. So this is the symmetry, and now we want to check how our Lagrangian changes to see if we have an infinitesimal symmetry. So this is our infinitesimal variation, and now we want to check the symmetry property. How do we do it? Well, we just take L at phi plus epsilon delta s phi, et cetera, et cetera. And we compute an x. And we compute this. Of course, we get L at phi, et cetera, x plus epsilon. And here we derive dl in d phi. And we multiply, which is changed by delta phi. And then there is epsilon dl over d mu phi I, and how much this changes is d mu of this variation phi plus higher orders. Now we plug in this specific expression, so and here in particular, we notice that this object here will be d mu of a nu d nu phi. But this is the same as a nu d nu of d mu phi. So if I write it like this, and I write this other one as a nu d nu phi, I see that this is the same as translating the axis by A in all my arguments, except the one where I derive in my Lagrangian explicitly.
Oops.
New. So sorry, this is equal to L phi, etc. plus epsilon this plus. So we have our original unperturbed Lagrangian plus epsilon times what? So this is the total derivative that derives the x dependence of my fields and also the explicit one. Everywhere x's appear here, this will derive. And this just derives the explicit dependence. Why I have to subtract this? Because it's not appearing. So if this term vanishes, then we are back in our original situation. Like, not the original, but I mean in the situation that gives rise to the theorem. So if, oh, that's crazy. So let's maybe make this more explicit. This acts on the x dependence here, here, and here, whereas this one is the one that would see only the explicit one. So what we want is that this term is not there. So translation. R is symmetry if and only if dx of L phi d phi x is equal to 0. So, and by this I mean no explicit dependence on x. It's like for energy in mechanics, we don't want explicit dependent on time. Of course, the quantity inside will depend on time through the configuration of our particle or of our field, but we don't want it to depend explicitly on it. Then, in this case, R mu of S can be chosen to be A mu L, which is what we write there. A nu is a constant, so it can just be moved inside and outside. Okay, then next step. Now we have computed R. We have found the hypothesis that makes translation a symmetry. We have computing the corresponding R, and then we apply Noether, and we find that J mu for this for A, our translation of parameter A, will be given by dl over d mu phi I delta. Well, what is, well, let me write the general formula, and then we specialize it. So this is equal to A mu. This is proportional to A. This is proportional to A. So let's put it A nu here. So this will be dl over d mu phi I. This is what? This is d nu phi I. And this is delta mu nu L. So why I pulled out I? Well, first A, first of all, is linear, this expression, so it makes sense. But most importantly, this A is sort of arbitrary. We picked one direction, but unless this Lagrangian is peculiar in the way that it doesn't depend explicitly on one direction, but it does on the other three. In general, if it has no x dependence like this, any A would do. So the interesting quantity is not so much this j in that case, but rather this object over here. So we give it a name, and we call this. So we have t mu nu a nu, and t mu nu equal to dl over d mu phi I d nu phi I minus delta mu nu l is the canonical stress energy tensor. And this is from the arbitrariness of A. So since A mu is arbitrary and constant, what happens is that d mu j mu a is equal to zero if and only if d mu t mu nu is equal to zero. So this is, of course, the reason why this object is interesting, is because it is conserved and it does not depend on this arbitrary quantity A. So we gain one index by saying that this must be true for all possible A's. Good. So let's look at some examples and get convinced that the name stress energy tensor is making sense. Any questions about this derivation? So let's start with phi d mu phi, our friend, the scalar Lagrangian. Now we can, in fact, since we have a nice explicit formula, we can apply it. Maybe I should talk about the charges briefly before going there. So let me just write Q. So Q is the integral of J0 over a 3D surface. But what is this? This is, since this is linear in A, this will be A mu times the integral of something else, of t 0 mu over the 3D sigma. Maybe let's call it nu so that I don't change names, but of course it doesn't matter much. So these objects, they serve its own name, and it's what I will call p. So the charges are these p nu, and which are the integral of t0 nu. And now we want to interpret what these guys are. So let's start from this one. Then we compute t mu nu. Well, this is kind of easy because deriving by partial mu phi just give us twice partial mu phi with a minus. So we get minus d mu phi d mu phi minus delta mu nu. So we get the plus here, 1/2 d rho phi plus v phi. And then we get that p nu is equal to the 3D integral of what? Of minus d0 phi d nu phi plus delta 0 nu. Let me just call it L for now, for short. and then we will investigate better what it is. So you see, this is a minus over here. This is upstairs. I can take it down and put a dot. So this is the time derivative of phi, d nu phi, and that's the second piece. Good. So let's start with P0. P0 is the integral over sigma of d3x phi dot square minus, well, plus. So what do we get here? We get minus 1/2 phi dot square plus the gradient, the space-like gradient of phi square. Sorry, 1/2 again. I forgot the 1/2 gradient phi square. And then there is plus v. And this is because we're looking at the zero component, so this contributes. So this is phi square minus phi dot square is just this guy. Plus 1/2 dot square plus the gradient square plus v phi. This is quite clearly a positive definite quantity, that, and it's the energy density. This is, if you have a chain of harmonic oscillators and you take the continuum limits, you would get an expression like this. So this is energy. So the integrand is the energy density, and the integrated quantity is the total energy of the field. Very good. So so if we have a covariant, if this has a Lorentz index, it's clearly Lorentz covariant, this expression, and its first entry is an energy density, this will be an energy momentum tensor. So it cannot be really anything else. So from this, we deduce that P nu is the energy and the momentum. So it's a energy momentum four vector. So as expected, we know that in mechanics, invariance under time translations gives conservation of energy. We are making things relativistic, and in relativity, energy and momenta are related. We find that momenta are here, invariance under space-time translations give us conservation of the energy momentum four vector. If you want to write the other components, in fact, it's even easier because these are integral over dt3. This does not even contribute of phi dot gradient phi. So, oops. So this is the momentum of your field, and this is the energy of the field. Okay. Good. So this allows us to interpret this object as the energy momentum four vector. Now, let's see if this helps us understand what T mu nu is. So by Lorentz covariance. So we're not using all the data we have. We still have that data. So we used this conservation law to know that the P nu is conserved. However, we can, in fact, get a bit more out of it to study also what the other components of these vectors are. So suppose, consider a space-time region with the following shape, like a nice cylinder. We have R region, so this is time, and this is space. So we get our normals in both directions. So maybe this is, let's see which names I want to give. And we look at the integral inside here, the integral in M of d mu t mu nu. So this is the space-time integral inside that region of this divergence, and this is zero. These, by the divergence theorems, become an integral on the three components of the boundaries. So we get t0 nu at, let's call this r0 and r1, and I call my sidewise boundary b. B is partial r times a time interval. So this becomes the integral over r0 of this thing, over r1 of this, minus the integral over r0 of the same thing, plus the integral on the time-like boundary of, now we get si ti of nu, where this is the, so maybe I want to write it a bit better. So this is the integral from t0 to t1, and the integral, a 2D boundary integral over partial r, and here we get the space-like normal here, si, with ti nu. So these we know how to interpret. These are the integral of the energy momentum densities of, so this is p of region r1 minus the momentum of region r0 plus, and here we have a flux. So and so this equation told us that this was a energy momentum density. With the zero up, and this is telling us that these are energy momentum fluxes. Maybe I should call them currents, but I think fluxes is a slightly better word. So this is telling us how much. Suppose nu is equal to zero, how much energy is flowing through a boundary in direction I, through the surface in the I direction. And if I put here j, it's telling me how much momentum in direction j is flowing in the direction I, and so on. So let me write one of these. So t I zero is the flux along xi of energy, and tij would be the flux along xi of momentum of J momentum. So I mean momentum in the direction J, the J component of the momentum, not the linear moment. So this gives us the following picture for so here we get an energy density, epsilon energy density. These are momentum densities. This is an energy flux. And these are kind of shear strains. These are momentum, linear momentum fluxes. In this is if you have a fluid. So if you have a thermalized fluid, you know that this object will be isotropic proportional to the identity with the pressure, the same pressure in all directions. So if you have a thermalized box, you know that through every side of your box, there will be this, the pressure is due to the particle bouncing against the wall. So it means that they're transferring a certain momentum towards the walls and is the same in all directions. So this will be PPP, 0, 0, and so on. So if a thermalized fluid would have epsilon, well, 0, 0, P. So these are pressure, P, P, P. I mean, a perfect fluid is necessarily thermalized. But whereas if you have a stream of particle moving in one direction, then it's not thermalized in that frame. And then it will not look thermal. So also, this is telling us that whether something looks thermal depends on its rest frame, but on which frame we look at. But that is a bit of a... This is more of a side note. What I care about is mostly this. Stresses. Okay, so this is the interpretation we got for the steam you knew. Just starting from this example of the scalar field theory suggests itself to interpret it like this. Now in the last 40 minutes, I want to introduce the Lagrangian for electromagnetism and do the same computation electromagnetism and see what we get out of that. And there will be surprises.
This TIJ or TMU?
TMU. This is TIJ, of course, and these are the zero. So now I will introduce a Lagrangian for electromagnetism and prove that, yes?
Sorry,
yeah.
Can you leave the top word a little bit? I'm trying to write some of this stuff.
Oh, like, oh sorry. I leave it halfway. Yes?
So the momentum we just computed, is it the canonical momentum? Because to me it doesn't seem quite...
This is the object that generates translations.
So the
right?
Canonical momentum isn't really a momentum.
What do you call momentum? The object. Oh, in the canonical analysis.
Yeah.
Ah, no. So okay, good. Thanks. there is, this is good to clarify. So P mu is is the linear momentum of the field, is the total, in fact, is the it's integrated over everything. Now, and is conserved. And is conserved. Now, what you're talking about, the canonical momentum, meant as the conjugate quantity in the Hamiltonian formalism to the field itself, is a different object. So not to be confused. With, so this is, in other languages, they don't call everything momentum. So in Italian or French, you could also say the quantity of motion. So this is MV, is the quantity MV, how much impulse your object has when it moves. So if you have a field configuration, a wave packet that is moving, it is telling you how hard it will going to hit you, this thing. The canonical momentum, pi, is a mathematical object in the canonical analysis, which is, let's say, equal to dt. So this is a little... let's do it like this. Dt How do I want to write this? Sorry. Okay, this will look very weird. I'll try to justify what I'm saying. I hope it's explained better in the notes. So with this quantity pi, which is the canonical momentum, which set, and in the sense that is the quantity that satisfies phi x pi y equal delta x y. So this is a Poisson bracket. So these are the, you know, if we start from a Lagrangian theory and we go to the Hamiltonian theory, we need to do a Legendre transform. And the Hamiltonian theory is about time evolution only, not space-time evolution, is really picking a direction time, singling it out, and looking at evolution in that direction. So it's not a Lorentz covariant formalism. So in that way, I have a canonical variable phi attached to each point of space, which evolves over time. And the Legendre transform tells me that this is, for that theory that I'm looking, the original field at time t and position x. It's conjugate momentum that I obtain by doing the Legendre transform at position x and time is the time derivative of phi. So this is the analog of q equal position and p equal velocity, roughly, in mechanics. But I have one of these choices for each point over space. And I'm really breaking space and time into two different things. And the bracket is taken at fixed time, so because my phase space is given just by this object, and this is how they evolve over time, and the bracket over field space is given by that. So this is the canonical momentum of the theory, which is nothing to do with this linear momentum, which is this quantity of motion. So this is a mathematical concept that in particle mechanics is the same as this linear momentum, often, not always, like in for charged particles, they are corrected by the A. But in this case, they're clearly two different concepts. So if you want to write, for example, this, you see that this is big pi over there and the gradient of big phi. So these two have nothing to do with each other. So npi is equal to the integral over d3x of pi at x and gradient of big phi at x as well. And this object is the one that generates translations in this lab through this bracket. And we get, I will raise the blackboard, sorry. I see some necks going. And we get that this, if I contract it with AI, will be AI DI phi. So this is generating translations. And the same if I do it for pi. So this is the generator of translations. So the analogy with mechanics is preserved, but more subtle. So all these objects are the same object in particle mechanics. Here, they play different. There is this pi which wasn't there in particle mechanics. So both pi. As a generator and as the moment, the conjugate momentum are all the same object here, they're different. And so I didn't want to do the canonical analysis for fields. So you can find details in the lecture notes. It would take too much time. But this is the half a blackboard sketch of what's going on. So for Maxwell theory, I will just write down a Lagrangian, and I will not justify where it comes from. I just will show a posteriori that it gives the right equations of motion. Yes?
In the PMU expression, should the first row be momentum density?
Maybe I'm mixing rows and columns. I did it all my life. It's either that or it's transpose. I'm not sure. Max. No, I think, isn't it correct like that? T zeros with, well, T with a zero up are the densities. In any case, very often this guy will be symmetric. So I have.
T zero zero is the energy, and then T zero one is along x. T02 is around y, T03, so they're all in the same row, basically. All the energy density and the momentum density should be the same.
Okay, I let you figure it. I will make a mess out of these and it's. But a remark that I haven't made is that this guy is symmetric, in any case, and in fact. Here is not clear why we would like it to be symmetric, but it's explained again. This would be too much of a tangent. If we want to use this object to define an angular momentum that is conserved, we would need T mu nu to be symmetric. Otherwise, it will not be a good proposition. But let me. I find. This is more important, so I rather focus on these. And if I have time, I will come back on the symmetry. So one would expect that maybe we can write a Maxwell theory, a Maxwell Lagrangian that only involves the fields E and B. This is not really possible, and an argument is given in the notes. What you can do for sure without any issue is to write a Lagrangian theory for Maxwell theory that depends on A, and this is given by the following. D for X, well, maybe let me fix F mu nu, where this F, of course, are A and B's, but I need to think of them as functions of this A. So the fact that I can write it in terms of F and not A, it is telling me that this is gauge invariant. So it doesn't depend on that psi ambiguity that we talked about. But I need to think of this as being given by A and B's. If F was its own thing and I took a variation here, I would find that the equations of motion are F equals zero. So it's clearly not a good idea to do that. I need to think like this. So now let's look at the equations of motion. So delta, sorry, S. Oh my bad, sorry. S is minus 1/4 of this. So the equations of motion are delta S equals zero. What is delta S? Well, delta 4x. Here I have two copies of it, which gives me a 1/2. Of this. And this, of course, there is a eta, like a Minkowski metric appearing. There are two Minkowski metrics appearing here, but these are constant matrices, so I don't vary them. And that's where these two come in from. I have these. These are also two copies of the same, because this is antisymmetric, so this is contributes the same as that. So this is just equal to minus F mu nu d mu delta A nu. I integrate by parts, and I find d mu F mu nu delta A nu. And here I find the boundary piece, which is N mu F mu nu delta A nu. So these, this is what, this is equal, if you look at where it's coming from, is equal to this guy, which is what I was calling pi. Let's leave, that doesn't matter. So this one we throw away because it's a boundary term and delta A is kept constant. So we understand that this equal to zero is our boundary condition. Sorry, condition for the action principle. This is the quantity we want to keep fixed at the initial and final surface. And this is a 3D integral. And this is the these are the equations of motion. What is the other equation of motion? Well, it's automatically satisfied because we are choosing F to be given by this, right? So the other equations of motion is the equations that tell us that such an A exists. So we are implementing it by the get-go. So this is a good Lagrangian for Maxwell theory in vacuum without sources. You can add the the action that we use to derive the Lorentz force. If you want to add particles, charged particles to this, you're not going to look into that. So this is a good action. It's gauge invariant, gives us Maxwell equation as equations of motion. What about stress energy momentum? The stress energy momentum tensor. So it's independent of x, the Lagrangian, so it will give translation invariant. We have dx of L Maxwell is equal to 0, so it's a check. And then we can compute T mu nu according to our formula. D L over D of D mu A rho D D nu A rho. So here in this formula, what I'm doing is to this is phi I, right? This is what was phi I before. Minus delta mu nu L. So let's compute. The first one, the first one is a bit like here. It gives us minus 1/2 f mu rho. No, sorry, minus f mu rho. Because as here we had is there are four terms contributing to this. And here is the same thing. So when I'm deriving by this quantity, it's like extracting the coefficient of this term, which is minus f mu nu. So this is that. Then we get d nu a rho minus delta mu nu 1/4 plus 1/4 of f alpha beta alpha beta. I hope, oh, there is a typo in my notes. Great. I got this sign wrong apparently. So what do we see here? If you see an expression like this, you should get all uncomfortable and itchy. Why? What's really not okay with this expression? We want this to be, remember, energy densities, momentum densities, stuff that I can measure, stuff that if it comes, is going to hit you. It's not gauge invariant. There is this A sitting alone over there. So this is a big, if you see an A sitting alone or a derivative of A that is not in an F combination, that there's something happening. So first thing you should think, did I do something wrong? Then you check and you say, no, this is exactly what it comes out. There's something to be figured out. So this is not gauge invariant. I would say most often you did something wrong, though. So if you see an A sitting there and there is no good reason for it to be there, just be suspicious. In this case, is what comes out. And now the great idea we have is, okay, these J mu's, etc., were in the end not really absolutely defined quantities. I can redefine them by choosing the superpotential I like. And the question now is there a superpotential that fixes this problem? So, idea, we had that g mu, I could redefine it. Idea, use ambiguity to fix this issue. So this is the ambiguity in A. Of so what does it mean for, maybe let's call this rho, so we don't get confused. What is the same thing for T mu nu? Well, T mu nu is nothing else than J is nothing else than T mu nu contracted with A. So I just, if this is true for J, it must be true for this. For this guy as well. So I want to use this idea over here. Can I find a psi that makes this gauge invariant? So the question that I want to answer is, oops. Is there a psi rho mu mu anti-symmetric in the indices, in the upper indices, that makes T mu nu gauge invariant? This is not too hard to see that such a choice sort of exists. The catch is it exists on shell, but we don't care because everything we measure is on shell anyway. So we can fix this problem. So we consider this to be f. Now I hope my signs are correct. So I would like f f mu rho in you. What about this? We check together if I put the indices in the right order. So we check our T mu nu is given by minus. So I start with this contribution. So this will be minus d rho. So let's write it like this: d rho of minus this. And then I put the old one. So let's see what happens. Well, we get this divergence, which vanishes on shell. So we get minus d rho f mu rho A nu, and then the second term is minus f mu rho, and here we get d rho A nu. My sign is wrong. Great. So this is a plus. We get minus d rho A nu minus d nu A rho, which is f. Good. So this vanishes on shell. And physically speaking, whether it vanishes on shell or off shell, for our purposes, doesn't really matter because these things are conserved and make sense only in on-shell situations of shell, who knows what these are. So we are happy with this, and therefore we are left with something that on-shell looks like f mu rho f rho mu plus 1/4 d mu nu. Which is our, maybe let's call this bar, I don't know, with the bar here. Because the one that I want to remember is the last one, not so much the one with the extra piece. So this is called the improved stress energy tensor, the sometimes or the Bell-Infante Rosen stress energy tensor. So this is T mu nu is gauge invariant. Symmetric and of course from the neutral perspective conserve equivalent to the original one up to these total divergences equivalent to T mu nu up to a superpotential, at least on shell. And this is called the improved Bell-Infante, I think Rosen too, sometimes. I don't know. Anyway, Bell-Infante stress energy tensor. Now, I invite you to consider whether those boundary terms at infinity actually play a role or not. The point is the following. That in that integral at infinity will scale like R squared because it's a humongous sphere sitting at infinity, which scale like R squared. What are we putting inside there is FA. In the linear Vickers potential that we computed, A goes as 1 over R. It's like there are Coulombic terms that scale like 1 over R. So FA looks like it could go like 1 over R squared, which is not going to zero fast enough to compensate those integrals. This happens if you have a charge system. So if it's like a monopole effect, but at least a space like infinity, at null infinity, which is where radiation ends up, there are even more subtleties because we know that electromagnetic waves reach null infinity. So what I'm just trying to say is that this very innocent thing of throwing out boundary terms because anyway they don't matter in theories with long-range interactions is actually a subtle business. So there is more to be said about the story, but locally in a region in a lab experiment, this is there shouldn't be any difference in using one or the other. Yes.
Doesn't FA have 1 over R cubed?
So the question is whether the, I think it depends in which direction one is looking at these things, so I haven't done the full analysis, but F, the piece is something, the piece one is interested in, I believe, is, let's see, is these components, for example, for the energy density would be zero, the radial component zero. So A naught is phi, goes as 1 over r. And this one has two pieces, the time derivative of AR and the radial derivative of A naught. Now, the radial derivative of A naught indeed would have an r, r squared. The other one, it depends a little bit on the details. So I haven't done the, I haven't checked the computation. This is going to space like infinity. Going to null infinity, which is going on towards infinity, but along a null cone, a light cone, not along the space-like direction, but along a null cone, this behavior will be will even be different. So one has to be, what I'm just trying to say is that one has to be careful in these theories that have massless particles, that Coulombic tails. These are not fast decaying fields at infinity. They are actually quite... By the Gauss, you know that the Gauss law, no matter how far you are, if you integrate around the sphere, you will see how much charge there is inside. So these are not, you can't throw away these infinity, these surface terms for free. You have to check that it works. That's kind of my warning. I haven't done the check explicitly in this case. Okay, so finally, I want to look a little bit at the components of this. So let's look at T00. T00 is F0 rho, F rho 0 plus 00 is 1, F alpha beta. I hope I'm... So this one is E square. Now, because rho can't be 0 itself, it will be I. So this is 0 I, this is I 0. So this is F I 0 square without a sign because I need to take down the time-like index and move the other 0 on the other side. So is twice of this, plus now I have 0i, 0i, or 0i, i0, 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 so I get a 1/2 of f i0 square as well here. Oops. Let's see if I'm doing it right. Minus. Because now I pull down a zero and this flips the sign, plus 1/4 of epsilon ij k bk epsilon, let's do it like this, fij. So this will be e square minus 1/2 e square, which is 1/2 E square, and this, if you compute it, will be 1/2 B square. So this is the energy density of the electromagnetic field, which we could have found by other means. So it just checks with that. Then we compute T0i, which, since it's symmetric, has both the interpretation of an energy flux and of a momentum density. So in this case, we get F0 rho, F rho I, plus nothing, right? The other one is 0. So what is this object? This object is, so rho cannot be 0, because we have already a 0, so it has to be a j. So this will be F0j, FJi. What is this? This is the same f as fj0, which is e. So this is ej epsilon jik dk, and this is the pointing vector. Now, up to science, I'm not being super super careful about my sign. So this is, let's write it like this, E cross B. Well, it seems that I get a minus here, but the idea is the same. So this is the pointing vector, which we know is the momentum of the momentum density of the electromagnetic field, but also its energy density. And finally, you can also compute the last one, which maybe I do. J plus well, I let you do it. So the one, those that I wanted to emphasize are these ones. So in the notes, if you're interested, you will find more details about the angular momentum. So here we just look at translation symmetry. Of course, there is the full Lorentz symmetry for this. This one I'll erase because I'm not computing anyway. So one can do the full Lorentz symmetry of for both this theory, the scalar theory and the electromagnetic theory. And angular momentum is much more subtle than translations, so the discussion is much longer, more and more involved. But it's there if you're curious. The stress energy part is the most important one, also for future applications, because this kind of object will be the source of the gravitational field in GR. It's the right-hand side of Einstein's equation, this theme you knew, because it contains, you can see, is the object that generalizes, is the relativistically covariant object that contains the energy density. We know that energy density is mass density, so the gravitational field, if we want a relativistic theory of the gravitational field, should be sourced by this object, in fact. So because it's the covariant object that allows us to talk covariantly about mass densities. So this is this will be the right hand side in an Einstein-Maxwell theory, for example. And yeah, so that's it. Thanks for your attention. It's been really nice to teach this course. I'm sorry some of the lectures were a bit messier than others, and I hope you enjoyed it, and see you later this week, and for some torture and for more fun stuff in January. Thank you.
Thank you.